an American religious innovation that has literally changed our values about Christianity and our expectations of the church. And we see really the effect of the camp meeting movement and the tent revival movement all the way into today's society and the reality that we're living today. Just to kind of give everybody a bit of a context for this time period we're talking about, we'll go back 1620, Pilgrim Fathers land on the shores of Plymouth, Massachusetts. 100 years later, or a little over 100 years later, they did well for themselves. Prosperity is booming in the American colonies, and with that, also, spiritual climate is cooling off quite a bit. Enter a period of time that we call an first Great Awakening. And this is a revival in which, if you've heard the names George Whitefield, if you've heard the name Jonathan Edwards, these are the big names associated with that, although the movement was quite a bit bigger than just those two men. Revival spread throughout the American colonies.
The famous sinners in the hands of an
angry
God.
Angry God and all that. So this happens and goes on. About 40 years later, we have a very messy divorce with England in about 1776. And the war is over. 1787, we're drafting our Constitution. The next year, Washington is elected. And basically the 1790s are the years of George Washington. Something else is going on at this time. There is a spread from the East Coast into the West, and there's all sorts of settlers moving out in the 1790s, moving West. Now, out here in Oregon, we've got to clarify what West means.
All right.
Because West in those days meant you were going to the next state over, okay? They thought the West was like
Ohio,
Western Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Kentucky. That was the Wild West.
Across them Blue Ridge Mountains.
Exactly, in America. And it's during this time that another revival comes to America that we call the Second Great Awakening. And so it's in this time period that this whole idea of the camp meeting and the tent revival goes on. I just want to say one other thing, and that is that there is a shift after the American Revolution in people's attitudes towards pastors and towards churches. Prior to the American Revolution, the average minister was considered part of the aristocracy of America, highly educated, upper class.
Oh, I see.
Read his sermons, very well written, very tightly argued sermons, wore vestments, that sort of thing. After the Revolution, people are kind of fed up with the highfalutin people. And there is a real strong attitude in America called basically the democratization of America. It's this attitude that nobody's above me. You know, we're equals in this place, and I don't have to obey people who think that they're better than me. And there becomes a new kind of preacher in America that becomes very successful, and that is what we would call, for lack of a better word, the frontier preacher. And the frontier preacher is a guy who is more humbly educated, if educated at all. As a matter of fact, some of them wore it as a badge of honor that they had no formal training or any formal schooling, just had the Bible. People that lived humble lives, they were definitely men of the people. Many of them were people who worked with their hands. They were just a different breed of person in line with the humble settlers.
You know, I have to agree. The circuit riders are really colorful. Bunch of folks. One, they are just hard as nails. I mean, they're working people.
Okay, so these are pastors that are on their horse going.
Basically,
from town to town?
One of the most famous is Francis Asbury, who I think over his ministry of 30, 40 years, he rode over 300,000 miles.
Wow.
on muleback. Just traveling up and down, you know, there weren't enough pastors to go around, so each guy would, you know, he'd travel to 8, 10, 12 parishes, whatever, you know, churches, and just deliver his messages. But these guys were, like, if there was a heckler in the crowd, you know, if they started preaching in the town square and there's a heckler in the crowd, they'd wait in the crowd and beat the snot out of this guy. I mean, this is, they're...
They have
I'm glad Rick doesn't do that.
They thought nothing of putting their knees in the back of a rowdy person in the crowd.
Well, and they had to. I mean, you know, they're out like Christopher said. When across the Blue Ridge Mountains, west of the original 13 colonies, where everybody's going. I mean, this is as rugged, you know, frontier as it gets. I mean, people would pull guns and knives on you, you know, if you were preaching a message.
This is Dan'l Boone kind of.
Oh, this is like full on, we'll lift your hair, you know, if we don't like what you're saying.
A lot of people were fugitives from justice. They were actually out there running from the law.
As a matter of fact, that brings us to where we're going to start our story here, to the southwest corner of Kentucky, which was the most hideous cesspool of murdering, horse thieving, lying, running from the law, hiding out from society, collection of a motley crew is what
I
these
thought
guys
you were talking
were.
About our church there for a moment.
Well, God love them. No, these guys were really bad, and there were a few Christians, but the Christians that were there and the preachers and pastors that were there were really in despair. And another one of these circuit riders, a guy named James McCready, kind of got the idea, you know what, why don't we just call together, you know, the four or five churches that I pastor. Let's just get everybody, you know, in for a camp out lunch, and we'll do a big communion outside, you know, kind of like our summer outdoor services and stuff. And
little church unity going on.
Yeah, just for fun. And so they did, and they brought them out to a place called Red River, and this is in the year 1800. And everything was going fine, and, you know, and they spent Friday, you know, kind of whooping it up, having fun, potluck dinner, and Saturday they were praying and singing. And long about Saturday night, I think it was McGreedy is preaching on sin and the need to repent. And boy, some of the gals start just really sobbing and wailing really loudly, and then a couple start fainting. And before you know it, we've got a full-out Pentecostal outbreak here, and McGreedy doesn't know quite what to do with it, but he flows with the flow, and they go ahead and end up having their communion, and they all get together Sunday morning the next day, and they're a little bit stunned. I mean, they've got 500 people there. That's a huge crowd for back and then. And they're all a little wondering, well, what's going to happen today? And sure enough, the same thing starts up. Well, to make a long story, goes away just shaking his head, kind of amazed at what the Lord apparently has done here. And said, well, I'll have another one. You know, we'll get over at Gaspar River, another one of my, you know, parishes, and they have one there, and the news has gone out about what happened here at Red River, and so they go to the one at Gaspar River, and instead of 500, 8,000 people show up.
Traveling, by the way, sometimes as far away as 100 miles.
It takes a week.
Which 100 miles is not like it is today.
You got to quit your job.
Yeah,
you know,
to take off.
You know, who's going to watch the animals, blah, blah, blah. But you got 8,000 people show up for this thing. So McGreedy is starting to realize the hunger that is going on in this part of the country, and he starts preaching again, and a couple of his buddies he's got helping him, and sure enough, boy, the Spirit comes on him in a big way. I mean, we're talking slain in the Spirit, people laying in the halls, and weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth, and it would scare most of us. and to be honest, they didn't know quite what to do with it either, but gosh, lives were changed as a result of it. I mean...
And what are you going to do? You can't do anything about this.
No.
It's like,
How are you going to stop it?
They planned the meeting, and then God showed up and took the whole thing
away
from
them. That's all you can do.
They had to go with the flow.
Well, that's not the end of the story. I mean, that you'd think that was a pretty big deal. But the news of that spread out, and a fellow by the name of Barton Stone, who's just a few stone throws down the river from old MacGready, he gets an idea, and he says, well, you know, this is wonderful. I mean, we ought to fire something like this up here in the little town of Cane Ridge.
Which is near Lexington.
Near Lexington, about 20 miles out. And so they do, and they're preparing. You know, they think, well, the Lord might move, so let's be ready for a few thousand people. You know, we'll get benches and you know, some tents and blankets and food, you know, and dig some privies and all the stuff you got to do when you're taking care of a few thousand people. And 25,000 people show up. We're talking empty in the three adjoining states here.
Mercy turbulence.
Well, it just goes on more and more. Pentecostal demonstrations, preaching, weeping, repentance, and what ends up happening, everybody stays the entire week. Well, that pretty much is the end of that in terms of being a quiet little country meeting. The news of this just travels, you know, all up and down the country. Within a month, probably everybody in America has heard about what has gone on down at Cane Ridge. As a matter of fact, in later years, prayer meetings would open with, Lord, please let this be another Cane Ridge. I mean, it was so electrifying. I mean, it's moving into the villages, into the towns, up to Philadelphia, Charleston. It gets to New York. I mean, people are being converted left and right. They're just, it's going crazy. There's a great story of a sailship, cargo ship is coming into the New York Harbor, and the harbor master goes out to bring them in the channel, and is talking to the guys and the crew and telling them what's going on in there. And the crew is all really quiet and hushed and standing around, and the captain. By the time they dock, three-quarters of the crew have given their lives to Christ. Just on the basis of what this one man is saying. And I multiply this story by 10,000.
Because it's happening all over the West now, by this time.
It's unbelievable.
Can I just add, too?
No, I wish you wouldn't.
I want to add that, because here is something where God came and took and met these people and did something beyond their wildest expectations there.
Yeah.
But this happens in 1800. 2 years before, the denominations in the East were getting very discouraged as they had their ministers and representatives going out and assessing the spiritual state of the frontiers. They saw the darkness, and they actually, like the Presbyterians, called it for a day in 1798, 2 years before this event, a day of prayer and fasting that God will deal with the Egyptian darkness that had come over the American frontier.
Wow.
And so this wasn't just a totally random event, but actually a visitation of God because of the prayers of his people, that they were praying that God was going to do something out in this frontier area.
Well, and it's hard to deal with, too, because, I mean, for, you know, clergy who are grown up on, you know, the Pauline admonitions, you know, that there will be order in the service and stuff like that, and you wonder, well, here, my golly, we got screaming and yelling and on, you know, am I supposed to jump in and stop this? I mean, even, who was it? My utmost, Oswald Chambers. Didn't he have a time like that? Where it's just, so they're really not sure what to do. And one of the problems is it's very easy to fake some of this. And there were abuses. There were counterfeit manifestations of the spirit. Sometimes, you know, you'd get a sexual predator type of guy who would fake this stuff, and just so he could get some little farm girl off in the bushes. And as a matter of fact, they actually had guys going around the camps with lanterns and big white sticks, beating the bushes to make sure.
Have you ever heard that phrase, beating the bushes?
So that nobody's snuggling in the bushes. And they got pretty bad press for that. I mean, and there was drinking in some places.
And the press at one point said that they felt like there was probably a whole lot more begetting of souls than converting of souls at some of these meetings.
Well, you know, the abuses did get a lot of press. Yeah. Not like the fair and objective press we have here today in America. But they really gave the camp meetings a hard time. And yet, bottom line, in spite of the abuses, lives were changed. There were towns and cities where the crime rate plummeted. Spousal abuse ceased to exist. Alcoholism disappeared. Taverns closed down. They turned taverns into stables, theaters into churches. It's just unbelievable stuff is going on. So, you know, in spite of the discomfort of giving up the control when the spirit takes over, the clergy and the spiritual leadership had to look at this and say, my gosh, God really is doing something here.
Well, then something else happens. This goes on, you know, the camp meeting, the tent revival kind of thing goes on for many years, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But then in 1820, we have another person emerge on the scene that a lot of people have heard of. A gentleman by the name of Charles Grandison Finney. And Finney becomes really the next wave of revivalist. Mm-hmm. Finney's an interesting
fellow. I don't think they saw your little quote
they
signs
didn't, yeah,
with your
didn't
finger.
See,
okay.
But I did the little quote-unquote revivalist. Finney had a different view, and that was that revival was an application of different means. And so Finney did the meeting hall. He did the rented tent, he did tickets, he did advertising, he did very, very strongly emotional sermons.
He took some heat for this, didn't he?
Yes, he did. All to create a mood of wanting to convert people to Christ. And Finney actually is, in the American scene, the first person that we know of that is really doing the... You must make a decision for Christ. You must convert tonight. You must come forward in front of everybody tonight and do some public demonstration that you have made a decision to follow Christ. That really has its origins in Charles Finney, which is part
of
this.
The altar call kind of thing.
The altar call thing. He had actually what they called the anxious bench, which was a special bench at the very front of what they had, that if you felt anxious for your soul, you would come up to the anxious bench, and then there would be counselors and all that to meet with you. So Finney actually becomes, if you will, a new kind of revivalist, but a continuation of this overall large revival.
Didn't you say earlier this even affected the way we do politics?
Absolutely. Now, this is not my thinking, and so I don't want anybody to think that I am incredibly brilliant here, but rather I would refer to Notre Dame historian Nathan Hatch, mm-hmm. who points out that in this time period, you can see that there is a shift in American politics, and that American politics, beginning with Andrew Jackson, who happens to be president at this time, begins to take the turn from very elaborate political discussion in the upper echelons of Congress and political leaders. They begin looking at the revival preacher, and they say, you know, this is wildly successful, and it really resonates with the American public. And so what they began doing was taking their cues from the revivalist preacher and starting to couch political arguments and political thinking in phrases that are either or. You're either for this or against it. You've got to get on board with this, and making things into a cause and a crusade. That was not done prior to
Andrew Jackson. Are political conventions descendants of this?
No, we were having political conventions before that.
Thank goodness.
But be that as it may, there actually was an effect on American politics where they began saying, wow, we need to do things in such a way that they're going to resonate with the people. And they saw that simplifying very complex things and making a decision was the way to do it, the way to market it to the American public. And so people don't realize this. I've said this before on this show. I've said it to many people, and that is people don't realize that politics in America used to be way more dirtier than they are today. I know that some people have a hard time grasping that, but nothing used to be sacred in American politics. And things are way more cleaner today because television prevents a lot of lies from being told. And I know that sounds counterintuitive, But it really, there is a reality to that. But
yeah.
So anyway, Finney actually begins affecting even the way that we do politics.
Well, that's really a 40-year period from Cane Ridge to the closure of Finney's ministry. And that's really what we officially call the Second Great Awakening. And it's really where we see the initial use and the development of the tent revival, the camp meeting, and they didn't give up on it. In the 1840s, America entered kind of an interesting period. Spirituality kind of fizzled a little bit because everybody was getting so uptight over the slavery issue.
Right.
Gosh, there were huge stock market crashes, kind of like the Depression in 1929, and things were bad. Things were tense. People were just, they were too almost frightened to get hooked up with spirituality. But for some strange reason, just prior to the Civil War in 1857, a new movement breaks out that is not necessarily tied to camp revivals, but is very much related. And it was a prayer movement. And it was people gathering, kind of an urban camp revival, if you will, an urban camp meeting. People would get together in their the schools, in their workplaces, in their homes, and they would pray. And I mean, it took over whole sections of cities, all up and down the East Coast and out into the Midwest. And whole sections of markets would close for an hour or two a day as people would pray, and on a daily event. Well, this went on for like two or three years, and actually even into the Civil War. And what you really end up with is several historians have characterized the first half of the 1800s as being a period in which the United States was truly more of an evangelical nation than it had ever been before or ever has been since. From 1800 to 1850.
Prior to that time, we didn't have the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that time, we became more pluralistic.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really the high tide mark of evangelicalism. How about
well,
that?
It really stamped its character on the Civil War and on the development of the Wild West later. I mean, it really did. It made us who we are.
And it was a very fruitful time as well. And one of the things we always want to look for with, you know, was a revival real? Does it change things?
Oh, my.
And there was a legacy that was left. It's during this time that ministries such as the American Bible Society was being formed, the YMCA, Sunday School Union, all sorts of missions and colleges were launched, anti-slavery, orphanages, all sorts of things were coming into play in the American church scene.
Well, a bunch of organizations we just take for granted. We've always heard of them.
And they've been around. And then, of course, one of the things certainly that is part of being a Christian, even the church scene today, is the family church camp and retreat centers
yeah.
and all that sort of thing. You know, you didn't see Calvin doing that. You didn't see
right.
Martin Luther doing that. You didn't see the Anglican churches having that. But you do see the American churches doing that, a lot of churches even owning their own camps. Well, part of that is that thirst and that remembrance in the American imagination about the camp meeting. And they were found to be a very effective thing as far as even bringing families together and doing evangelism and teaching and propagating the faith. And so even that becomes part of the legacy.
Would you characterize that as a manifestation of a quasi-monastic impulse on the part of the Protestant church?
What?
Well, it's just fun. You know, it's one of the few ways that the Protestant church really manifests that getting away from it all doing the introspection thing, doing the meditation thing. We don't do that a lot. Not nearly like the monastic movement within the Catholic Church.
Definitely. Well, we don't have we don't have our monk cells or. There he goes doing his chanting again. So
okay.
we talk about what is the reality of this? What is the legacy of this? And one of the things I think. we want to talk about is just about some of the weird ecstatic things.
You know, you need to be careful. Like I say, I've been in this long enough to have seen both what I consider real Pentecostal manifestations, real spiritual manifestations, and pretty fake ones. And you know, ecstasy, in the words of Nash, ecstasy is no indication of orthodoxy. Just because somebody is flipping around and being apparently slain in the spirit is no guarantee that what they're doing is for real. It may be, but until you see fruit, you know, it's very hard to tell. On the other hand, you have to acknowledge the fact that we need to be humble before the Spirit and be ready for the unusual, because I mean it's his ball game, not ours. He's not constrained to use our plan and our agenda, as many clergy have found out. When the Spirit comes, he comes and he does what he wants to do. And for that,
absolutely. Something else that definitely is a legacy from this particular time period is the whole idea that American Christianity really differentiates itself from European Christianity in this camp meeting and tent revival period, especially in two particular ways. One of them is definitely in the more democratic forms of denominations and churches. Prior to this time period, it's the more staid, the more tried and true European denominations that are in power. Those begin to fade away, and we have more of the quote-unquote people's denominations, the more informal ones, the Methodists. They become wildly popular in America. Also, the Baptists. The Baptist denomination is also, to this day, the Southern Baptists remain the very largest denomination in the United States. And these are growing like wildfire. Why? They deal on real simple, humble levels with people, stressing personal piety, stressing a personal relationship with God, very informal. And that remains with us today. If you take a look at who's growing in America, it is still the more informal churches. Baptists are still huge.
Non-denominational.
A lot of other non-denominational kinds of churches are still the bigger, popular ones that are more of the quote-unquote informal people's churches. And so that's a big deal. And then also, there's another issue, and that is that American Christianity, unlike Christianity almost anywhere else in the world, is very much conversion-oriented. The number one purpose of Christianity to the American mind is conversion. You must be converted. We measure success in, did anybody get converted? Did you make a decision for Christ? And that's even more important than whether you're a member of a church. I mean, what's good as being a member of a church unless you're saved, you know? And so that can happen even outside of the church. And
well, that is different from Europe.
Conversionism, the church is not the continuer of civilization. It is not the civilizer of people. It is not the place where we have our roots and it holds us all together. Conversionism is the point of the church. And that is a big fruit and very much alive today in American Christianity. And that comes out of this second great awakening of camp meetings and tent revivals.
Well, you guys, thanks for explaining that to us there. You know, I just had a foreign exchange student from Germany, and he was shocked that when we went to church on Sunday, we don't go to a church? I mean, you're going down here to the high school?
Yeah, what's the
point
of that?
In the all-purpose room?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was... and then, you know, he showed us pictures of the two churches that were in his town. Glorious, gilded sculpture.
Oh,
no
God.
One was in them. No, they were empty, unfortunately, kind of the state of European Christianity.
Nice but, tourist attractions, though.
Yeah, and but anyway, so it underscores what you were saying there. Matt McAuliffe and Chris White, our usual monthly guests here with a snapshot of church history, church biography. 33 minutes after 12 o'clock. Lord bless you guys. We'll be back with more music here in just a moment on KDUF.
Part of today's